Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hi, Richard.
Lionel Burney.
Hello.
And Ellis Bacon.
Hi there, Richard.
Ellis is Lionel's co-editor at the Cycling Anthology, and this is a special podcast where we're going to talk about the latest edition of that and talk a bit more generally about cycling writing. It's nice to see that Ellis and Lionel have come wearing the winter collection, the Cycling Anthology winter collection.
Out soon.
Heavy woolen jumpers.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Tell me, first of all, the Cycling Anthology knitwear, is that available on the website? Or
it's available in the shops.
Autumnal colours as well.
A prototype.
So the third Cycling Anthology has just come out, and we did a Cycling Anthology podcast about a year ago when the first one was published, and we thought we'd do another one because there's some interesting things to talk about in the new edition. But before we get into that, perhaps you can tell us a little bit, both of you, maybe you first, Ellis, about how the Cycling Anthology came about.
Yeah, it was actually Lionel contacted me, so he has to be creative with the idea, really. But no, he contacted me. I'd spoken about, and still am speaking about, doing a website sort of along the same lines, coming soon. But so he got in touch because he heard about that and asked if I wanted to work with him on a collection of writing. And the idea really was to get cycling writers from magazines and newspapers together in one volume and sort of help promote cycling writing in general, get them as well to write about something that perhaps they wouldn't normally write about in their own magazines or newspapers, a chance to really sort of let loose with their own.
Yeah, the brief is quite unusual because as a contributor, and Daniel's a contributor as well, the brief is that there is no brief really, which is quite refreshing.
Well, that was one of the ideas that we wanted to develop, really, was that as we all work for newspapers, magazines, or write other books, generally speaking, somebody is either agreeing an idea that you've kind of formulated and then kind of steering you in the commissioning process. But there's never a kind of completely blank sheet of paper to work with, and we wanted to kind of capitalise on the explosion of cycling writing, the number of sort of, not just the people who've been cycling journalists for, 8, 10, and in some cases 20 or 30 years, but also some of the correspondents who've come to cycling from other sports, excellent writers, very good journalists and reporters, who are perhaps just kind of beginning their kind of journey into cycling. We wanted to try and bring all of those different voices together and have a collection which projected each individual voice, and I think so far in the three books, I think, is it 39 different essays, I think, so far? Something like that, 38 or 39 different essays. And I think they've all got their own individual voice of that particular writer, and they all cover completely different subjects. And we didn't necessarily want to restrain people with the usual constraints that perhaps a newspaper or magazine might have on them.
And it really is an eclectic mix, isn't it, as you say, because people, we thought we might get some people, two or three people might want to write about the same subject perhaps, but that hasn't really happened. It's sort of accidentally fallen together quite easily, I think.
I think cycling as a sport lends itself to good in-depth reporting, reportage and writing. I think one of the frustrations perhaps even in magazines that will allow a feature to run to 3,000 or 4,000 words is that there sometimes isn't the amount of space to really get into a subject. And then if you're writing a book about something, you've got a lot more space, but then requires a lot more research.
Yeah.
And this is kind of, the idea was to be sort of a halfway house between those, a bit like the sort of, the essay length pieces that some of the American magazines, the New Yorker and that kind of thing would do, but obviously all about professional cycling. So far, we've been absolutely delighted with the kind of the breadth of ideas that people have brought to it, and the knowledge and depth of expertise from these people who are actually out there. And I think, we've all, across all of us, we've all got our own little niches within cycling that we know perhaps more about than some others. And I think it's been good that people have been able to go off down their own little routes and shed some light on some of the subjects that mean something to them.
Daniel, any of the chapters in the three anthologies so far that have particularly sort of surprised you? Any one in particular?
Yeah, I mean, a couple that I was sort of envious of. I would have loved to have written Alistair Fotheringham's piece in the first cycling anthology about Oscar Freire. I mean, Alistair did a fantastic job of collecting stories, anecdotes about a very curious individual.
And
someone who, when you met him when you spent time around him was not that eccentric, but did some fairly eccentric things. Not, you know, not
just
a complete
quirky,
just very, yeah, quirky. The, you know, kept a spoon under the dashboard of his car, was it? Just in case, because he was so obsessed with yoghurts, just in case he happened to pull into a petrol station and find a new flavour. I mean, I remember spending...
You can't just carry on with your conversation. Like, you've got to stop. You've got to stop and let people digest that.
But this was fairly typical of Frere. I remember Serge Parsani, the Mappe director of Sport TV, say he was a 10 out of 10 on the bike, 2 out of 10 in real life. I remember spending a day with Frere at his house in about 2008. And... He told me stories about how just a few days earlier he'd fallen into a shopping trolley on a revolving walkway in the supermarket. He'd tried to go the wrong way down it or something, and the trolley had got caught, and he'd ended up inside the trolley careering down this gangway. But yeah, that was fairly typical, and organising an interview with him was a complete nightmare. I had to phone him three times the day before, just to remind him once, you know, before breakfast, once before lunch, once before his evening meal, and even then it was, he'd completely forgotten that was coming the next day. So yeah, that was one I particularly enjoyed, and I think, you know, those are the pieces generally that I've enjoyed the most, the ones that, you know, focus on people. Like someone like Oscar Freire, although he had a fantastic career, great palmarès, you wouldn't, you know, generally see a very long feature on him in an English-speaking magazine or
his
newspaper.
Greatest title was Spanish Scalextric Champion as well.
Exactly.
Wasn't it, I think? I can't remember if that's in Alistair's piece,
but only under 14. I think. Okay. I mean, set the records straight on that. Right, yeah.
This links to something Lionel said about cycling lending itself to good writing. It's not the same. It doesn't necessarily highlight the good writing, but it does highlight that cycling is a great subject, partly because there are so many, it's populated by so many of these interesting, unusual, enigmatic people, and also because, and we've spoken about this before, but the racing itself happens so much of it out of the public view. You know, you don't see most of what goes on, and so there is, every day there's this great mystery about what happened, and even though a lot of it's been captured by TV cameras, there's still a job to be done of piecing together what happened, which is why the reporter, the writer, is very important in cycling.
I mean, I think there's a huge amount of kind of cross-pollination as well, in the sense that it's rare in cycling for people to stay in the same team for, you know, more than 4 or 5 years. So over the course of a career, particularly someone like Oscar Freire, by the time someone spent 10, 12 years in the pro peloton, I mean, they've literally come into contact with hundreds, thousands of, you know, potentially thousands of other guys, whether they be direct sportifs, soigneurs, masseurs, and everyone has got some kind of story about a guy like Oscar Freire.
So you realise these people sometimes don't think they're important stories, and that's almost part of the skill of as a reporter or journalist, isn't it, to perhaps tease some of these stories out of people who say, oh, it's not important, and actually, you know, that's where the greatest stories come from. I mean, you know, who'd think that having a spoon in your compartment to a yoghurt.
For Oscar Freire, that's,
you know,
just part of his everyday reality,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly.
I think the other thing that comes through for me, reading all the pieces over the course of putting the three books together so far, is that nothing you witness as a journalist or reporter when you're out there at races or when you interview people, nothing really kind of goes to waste. It all gets stored away in the memory banks, and you just never know when it might become relevant to another piece. I mean, just talking about one of the pieces I wrote, the piece for Volume 3, which attempted to tell the story of the Tour of Britain over 10 editions, stuff that I'd sort of witnessed in 2004, 2005, kind of lent itself to a layered story telling the sort of evolution of that race and the explosion of British cycling, and just things that at the time wouldn't have seemed important because you've been there and you've seen, in that case, you know, so Bradley Wiggins as a 22-year-old and then as a 32-year-old or 33-year-old winning the race, you know, you've witnessed the kind of evolution of a man's career there, and there's never really an opportunity necessarily to kind of piece all of those little fragments together into a sort of longer narrative, and I think knit them together,
a woolen jumper.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but I think that's one of the things that a lot of the writers have kind of embraced, is that that stuff that has kind of just been lodged in the memory banks becomes relevant to a
just
piece,
like that.
And
It's like a rubbish bin for everybody's offcuts and things like that. Not at all.
That's the anthology.
Not at all.
The idea of it as well is that it's kind of, it's timeless, that their stories, you know, their contributors have written stories that perhaps can be enjoyed in, you know, years to come as well. But they're also sort of quite timely as well in terms of what's happening in the moment.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freed.
So I cut you off there, Alice. Sorry, what were you saying?
That's okay. I was going to just talk about your piece, in fact. Or indeed get you to talk about your piece. Because it's about the Women's Tour de France, and that this year has been quite a hot topic, really, hasn't it, as to whether the Women's Tour de France should be brought back and perhaps be run concurrently with the...
That's where I suppose I got the idea. The petition was launched, I think, during this year's tour. By Marianne Vos, Emma Pooley were driving that, and there was talk of, you know, resurrecting Women's Tour de France. But in a lot of the reports, there was the mention of the first ever winner in 1984, Marion Martin. And I must admit, I remember the Women's Tour in the 80s. I remember it being dominated by Maria Cannons and Jenny Longo, and I didn't remember Marion Martin at all. It wasn't a name that meant anything to me. So I decided to try and find her, and she's now a portrait photographer in Boulder, Colorado. I got in touch with her and spoke to her about her experience of winning that first tour. And it was fascinating because it was Felix Levitin, who was one of the co-directors of the tour at the time. It was his brainchild, really. He was very keen to take the tour to new frontiers. He was keen to really expand the sport and promote it in America and among women. And so the Women's Tour was part of that drive, really.
Just to say, Levitin was the kind of equivalent to Christian Prudhomme now. Basically.
Yeah. He was, there were two directors at the time, and he kind of managed the business side of it, I think, the finances and so on. And Mary Martin spoke about that Women's Tour. The way they organised it was that stages were about 70, 80 kilometres long, and they were generally the last 70 or 80 kilometres of each men's stage. So the transfers for the women were huge. They spent a lot of time in the car. One of the reservations that there was apparently at the time about longer stages was Jacques Godet apparently was very worried about how women would urinate on the move. So that influenced the shorter stages. But Mary Martin had a great time. The race was absolutely dominated by the Dutch. But when it hit the mountains, you know, living in Colorado, she was a good climber. She really came to the fore there and ended up winning the race quite easily. But there wasn't a lot of coverage for it. She said that even a couple of days from the end, she was wandering around the media village, and one of the TV stations said to her, "So what are you doing here?" And she said, I'm writing the Women's Tour. He knew nothing about it. And looking back through papers and magazines at the time, it really didn't get an awful lot of coverage. And I guess my chapter in the book explores that race. It tells the story of that race, but also looks at the history of the tour, of the sport, and tries to sort of examine the reasons why in cycling, as opposed to a lot of other professional sports like tennis and so on, the women's sport lags way behind the men's sport, and where women are visible at bike races generally as podium girls or in some peripheral role. And that's been the case now for over a century. And I just wonder if a Women's Tour de France is the way to address that. I'm not sure that it is. And I guess my chapter is almost an appeal for there to be greater support for women's cycling, but also not necessarily for there to be a women's tour. I don't think that necessarily works.
And it sounds as though, I mean, Prudhomme said he said it's impossible, really, hasn't he, for the moment, that the tour is just too big as it is to sort of add a women's race. And I'm sure we'd all like to see the Women's Tour de France back again, but, you know, perhaps there isn't the right place to do it.
As Mary Martin made the point herself, that women's cycling can't hope to be the same as men's cycling. It's got to be different. It's got to develop in a different way. And I think the Women's Tour of Britain next year is a great opportunity to create a new event that can grow and build almost apart from the women's cycling. I mean, in looking at the history, I read a book by an American historian, Christopher Thompson, which is very good on the sort of gender politics of cycling and how women were excluded from cycling and cycle racing, even the activity of cycling, you know, when the bike was invented. And he ties us in with this crisis of masculinity in France, which Daniel might know a little bit about, at the end of the 19th century.
What?
Well, you're a bit of a Francophile.
Oh, right.
You don't really have a crisis of masculinity.
That's what I'm not saying. He's having a crisis of masculinity. but this, it was very interesting how women... Christopher Thompson talks about this crisis of masculinity, which he says owed to three things, which were France's defeat in the Franco-Prussian War, the declining birth rate and the strength of Germany, the neighbour. And there was this sort of... women on bikes posed a kind of threat to masculinity. You know, even the fashions, the culottes and things they started to wear were seen as being less feminine. And, you know, the Tour de France, when it was established in the early 20th century, was seen as the ultimate sort of masculine test or test of masculinity.
Also because it was launched by... a newspaper which was essentially about automotive transport.
No? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that as well. But you know, the war metaphor was very important as well. Right from the start of the tour, it was men going off to do battle with each other, which again excludes traditionally and certainly excludes women. So I find all that fascinating. I think that all explains where we are now.
I think the calls for a women's Tour de France, which did come about during the tour this year, and you know, it kind of diverted the attention away from the real problem, which is that there isn't a strong, cohesive, coherent structure in women's cycling, and towards it being ASO's problem. And as I think we discussed this before on one of the tour podcasts, but the problem women's cycling has had has been that arguably the biggest race, the Giro d'Onore, the Women's Tour of Italy, has been held in July when the Tour de France is on, so it gets almost no coverage. It makes almost no, you know, it had almost no presence on the media landscape in the heartland of European cycling. And so, with the Women's Tour of Britain coming along and being held in May time, there's a chance that it might be able to sort of stand alone as an event in its own right, which is exactly what it needs to do in order to establish a sort of foothold.
I was going to say it almost needs to become like the Women's Tour de France. Don't try and call the best women's race the Tour de France. It doesn't need to be the Tour de France, does it? It can be its own right, own race, and why not perhaps the Women's Tour of Britain to be the main women's stage race?
I mean, also it's a blindingly obvious point, but I think people point the finger a bit too much ASO and as though ASO are under a moral imperative to promote gender equality in their event, when ASO is a private company and that they're, you know, primarily interested in, well, they're only interested in profit, really. I think if anyone is under a moral imperative to promote any event in women's cycling, it is the UCI. I mean, the UCI is a non-profit organisation, or should be. And it's very, very difficult to lobby a race organiser when men's events are already really struggling to stay afloat to introduce something which is going to, you know, burden them heavily financially. I mean, ASO has run in lost leaders, as it were, in the past. The Tour de l'Avenir lost money for years and years, and ASO has kept it going, although now in association with the Tour de l'Ain organiser, for the good of cycling. But ultimately, even there, it's because they know that it is important to promote other events for what is their cash cow, which is the Tour de France.
Coming at this from a point of view of a reporter covering the Tour, I mean, just trying to visualise how it would work if they were to run the Women's Tour de France the way they did in the 80s, basically in parallel with the Men's Tour de France, I just think it would be completely lost. It would be just dwarfed, swamped by the media coverage of the Men's Tour de France. I mean, in your chapter, Richard, there are some photos of Marianne Martin with Laurent Fignon.
Well,
the men's race and the women's race, kind of, the pictures of them all on the podium in Paris kind of gives the impression historically that they were in some way on an equal footing, and I just don't, from reading the chapter,
It's interesting that, and even that was my impression at the time, getting into the race and seeing Paris, even though I wasn't that aware of the women's tour as it was going on, the Tour Féminin as it was known, when you saw them at the, you know, in Paris together, on the sharing the podium, it did symbolically put them on a kind of equal footing. The story behind the photographs is quite interesting because Marion Martin, as I mentioned, is a photographer now, and she was very interested in photography back then. And because their stage is finished before the men's stages, she would go out and hand out caps to fans and things like that. And and hang around with photographers who she wanted to speak to and get to know and understand their job a little bit. And so she befriended one or two of the photographers who, after the race, sent her all these photographs that they had. And there are some extraordinary ones in her collection, a couple of which we've been able to include in the book, of her at the after party in Paris with Laurent Fignon and Cyril Guimard. Guimard, who was Fignon's director sportif, wearing an extraordinary outfit of white jacket, no shirt, and a black bow tie, and a huge medallion.
I think Guimard was topless for about 15 years
between 1980 and 1995. I've got a picture of him as well in the team car. Yeah. He's sitting there with his arm hanging out the window and he's topless.
He would wear very small shorts and flip-flops.
But you think that everyone was doing it at that time, but actually if you look at it,
it was only Guimard. But it was a bizarre outfit he was wearing that night to go out that he, you know...
As long as he was like a bunny girl.
It was like some, you know, Magnum PI.
We'll send him some funky knitwear, shall we?
with the curls, but without the moustache. Some funky knitwear, yeah.
Yeah, he'd like that, I'm sure.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Let's talk about the subject of writing, because there are different types of writing in this book and different types of writing as a journalist stroke reporter, with maybe emphasis on reporter. You know, it's interesting to read in the book something like Owen Slott's piece. Now, Owen Slott is a chief sports reporter at the Times, and a good, very good reporter at that. But he's written a kind of travel piece almost about being in Corsica in the week leading up to the start of the tour this year. You know, it's a totally different type of writing for him to do. It's a really enjoyable read. But Lionel, what can you sort of explain a little bit what you think about the different styles of writing that are contained in here, and also as a journalist writer yourself, how you wear these kind of different hats?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it does boil down. Cycling writing has kind of exploded in recent years. There are a lot more outlets, you know. Books, magazines, newspapers are doing more. Then there's a kind of proliferation in kind of comment and opinion type pieces.
It's a mass attack of diarrhea, isn't it?
We have to... well, hopefully not. I mean, hopefully there's some, you know, there's some good stuff. I mean, the idea of the anthology really was to try and bring all of that, as you made the point about Owen's piece there, he is an exponent of one particular type of journalism, and that is reporting, really. He goes, he speaks as he finds, or he interviews people and he reports kind of what they said in feature interviews and gets stories. And for him to choose to tackle a completely different style of writing in the anthology, that's kind of what the anthology is there for, because he's been there to the tour, he's witnessed all of these things. Part of his story is about riding the Corsica stages in the week leading up to the Tour de France, and his impressions, and that is all part of it, what you see and witness and the conversations you have and the people you meet. So really the idea of the blank sheet of paper, if you like, is to give people the opportunity to write the piece that they particularly want to write in the style that they particularly want to write it. Now, for some people, they may kind of stick with what they do most of the rest of the year, and for others, they might use it as an opportunity to do something very different. But in terms of what we all have to do, I think, at times, because cycling has grown so quickly and we at times have to be... wear different hats, if you like. We have to report, or we have to offer an opinion in a piece, or we just have to witness.
This is a great
observation and colour.
There is a misconception, I think, that everybody in the press room at the tour or anywhere is doing the same job and, you know, following the same agenda, if you like, and that isn't the case, is it?
No, you've got people there, like newspaper writers have got to get the story of the day across each day and every day, which is not easy to do, but it's quite a sort of set thing for them to do every time, whereas I've mainly been at the Tour de France writing for a monthly magazine, and the words are going to come out later once the event's over, and I mean, that on its own is, well, stating the obvious, but obviously quite a different type of writing that you have to consider time and place. And, you know, I suppose if you're doing an everyday kind of report of the tour, you're talking about the weather, you're talking about the surroundings and everything, and it's yeah, there are people doing very different jobs, and it's also very different between nationalities as well, I think, like different styles that perhaps the French traditionally have sort of a, you know, there's a bit more perhaps poetry perhaps to their writing, yeah. Whereas other nations might be a bit sort of more straight down the line, a bit more basic.
I don't know, Daniel, if Gazzetta dello Sport and the big Italian papers are the same, but certainly from reading L'Equipe during the tour, they'll have their two or four pages on a day, and they'll have maybe four or five writers, and each writer will take a different approach. They will have different responsibilities. Someone will do a kind of, you know, a kind of more blow-by-blow factual account of what happened in the day's stage. There'll be stuff from the start line in the morning, there'll be stuff from the finish line, there'll be featuring pieces, interviews, news. And I think where we've all come into cycling journalism, we've had to at various times do all of those different things. We haven't necessarily had the luxury to be able to focus down on one particular discipline. We've had to do a bit of everything, and I think probably it's been more enjoyable and more varied for that. But the closest example I can think of in sport in this country would be cricket, for example, where a big test match, there will be maybe three or four writers for one of the big papers, the Telegraph or the Guardian, and they will all be looking at a different aspect, a different angle, because there is so much to comment on and to absorb over a day's play. A stage of the Tour de France fits that kind of template quite well, I think.
I mean, not to make out that we have it hard in comparison to people who write about other sports, but I think the one thing that you consistently hear from other writers who come into cycling, maybe parachute into the Tour de France, and
not literally,
is the logistics. I mean, you make the comparison there with cricket. Generally, an event like a cricket match, you'll be in a press room, you'll be sitting there all day, and you'll be able, you know, you'll walk a few hundred yards to talk to whoever you want to talk to at the end of the day. I mean, even us having done it for a number of years at being at bike races, just the logistical challenges are considerable. You know, sometimes you're driving 300-400 kilometres a day, and you've actually got very little time to work in, haven't you?
I've got a friend who covered Wimbledon last year, and you know, 2 weeks, and at the end of it, I'm absolutely shattered. I had to get the tube every day from Parsons Green out to Wimbledon. Honestly, it was relentless, absolutely relentless.
To walk around all the courts.
Incredible. I just hung up.
I think that's one of the things that you kind of, you know, we're a few months after the Tour de France now, and hopefully all recovered. It is that huge logistical undertaking, isn't it? And we've all probably been in that situation where you've heard a story has broken and you're stuck on the auto route and you've got to get to somewhere quickly.
Brings back memories. Daniel and Ellis, I was with you, I think, 2008, Manuel Beltran.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
The liquid gas rider. It was 2008, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we were heading one direction and we heard that he'd tested positive, so I think we did a U-turn.
I think we were in the press room, and the kind of murmur always goes around, tends to go around.
We decided to go to the hotel, didn't we? But we were bordering on too late. Well, we were too late, really.
Did we not drive past
I think the police sirens were there blaring coming towards us, and we realised we'd missed him. But the aftermath was still pretty exciting, wasn't it?
We ended up dining in the hotel, didn't we, with the riders at the next table. Yes, it was slightly awkward, slightly uncomfortable moment. I mean, even people Pozzato was
looked vaguely,
but that does make cycling great, like you're saying about the sort of the logistics, the geography of it. I mean, it's so broad, but then you compare it to a supposedly literary sport like boxing. Well, it is. I mean, it's one of the other great literary sports, and it's hard to say why. The actual battle itself, I suppose, the boxing is exciting, but it's an indoor sport and everyone's just there.
I think with boxing, I mean, if you know Norman Mailer, the fight, that book is about the build up. You know, and it's like the match itself is the sprint finish or the final climb. There's so much else that goes into that contest that you can write about that you don't see. And that, I think, again, you know, there's so much going on there beneath the surface that explains the context to the fight. That I think that's why.
Yeah, but you could do this in any sport. That's what I don't really get. I mean, why isn't gymnastics, for example, literary sport? Because really, maybe that's why.
You know, I think there's a myth that in a tennis match or a football match that everything of interest happens before your eyes in the arena. And maybe that's what holds back a lot of sports writing about those sports, that there isn't enough for there isn't the access perhaps to know what's gone on.
When a lot of it comes out of tradition, you want tradition and history and things. Those things come into certain sports more than others. But and then I don't know. You look at cricket and things like the weather, the sky, all those kind of things come into play, don't they? I think in sort of particularly creative writing.
The point you made there, Richard, about having dinner at the next table to the Liquigas team on a day when one of their riders had tested positive. I mean, we've all been in that situation. And one of the things about the Tour and the Giro and the other big races is that you can just wander into the hotels and talk to the people, talk to your contacts, talk to people you know, and just kind of be in and around the environment of the Tour de France for more than just the start of the stage, the finish of the stage, and it's all of that stuff that kind of, I think, comes through in a lot of the pieces in the anthology. Is just this kind of low murmur of knowledge.
The murmur that you mentioned, Daniel,
is always there, just from having been out there and knowing the people that are involved and I think we kind of perhaps forget that when you pull up in a car park at a Novotel on the outskirts of the stage finish town and the Sky team are staying there and the Garmin Sharp team are staying there and the Cannondale team are staying there, you can just wander into the hotel and pick up little bits and pieces that will inform your knowledge of the race that you can't get from just watching on the TV. And I think perhaps we're sometimes a little bit guilty of underestimating the importance and the power of that kind of those little bits of knowledge that may not necessarily come out the next day in a piece, but over time they kind of get woven into a sort of broader understanding of the sport.
I mean, I think it is changing the line, and we perhaps the changes are very slight and they're sort of, well, very gradual. But you know, you look at even in the course of the last 10 years, even as recently as 6 or 7 years ago, a lot of teams were turning up to big races without a bus. I know there are a lot of riders now who would certainly prefer journalists not to be staying in the same hotels, and there are moves afoot, certainly at some races, some race organisations, to kind of stop that happening. And I think there is a slow whittling away of our access, which will take place, you know, over 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah, there's still, I mean, you know, Tour Qatar, Tour of Oman, which I covered last year, I think you've been out there as well, Ellis.
Yeah.
You dine every night in the room with the riders. I don't know if that would happen in any other sport.
No, I mean, finish lines at the Tour de France, for instance, I think it's a matter of time. I think it's every year. It's a matter of time before we are prevented from entering the area directly behind the finish line, simply because it's... I mean, I fully sympathise with the riders in this. It is very, very dangerous. And every single day, there is someone raises their voice, someone is knocked off their bike or... knocked into barriers. It's almost got...
Bradley Wiggins is taken to riding through that area with his fist raised, people to...
And I'm almost amazed every year when I go back to the Tour that, you know, we can still go into that area.
I remember Grenoble in 2010 after that time trial where, you know, Andy Schleck was in the yellow jersey, but Cadel Evans took it over that day, and Frank and Andy Schleck were both riding onto the podium, and I think Frank had finished first, and then Andy finished, and Frank came to find him, and...
Someone took his bike.
Andy Schleck had been, you know, swamped by people. And as Frank tried to get close to him, he was just overwhelmed by people. And he's not the biggest of blokes. And he was knocked right over onto the road and actually became detached from his bike, for a bit. And it was a highly dangerous moment, actually. And, you know, it was just reporters swarming around the pair of them and not really realising that Frank Schleck was there knocking him over. Not that difficult to do, really. Frank Schleck, he is a slightly built fella, isn't he? But it was dangerous, and it required some people to sort of create some space for him to actually get to his feet again.
You say all that, Daniel, and that's undoubtedly true about the tightening of access and the restrictions being placed on reporters. But there will still always be, even now, and it's probably as bad now in terms of having that free access as it's ever been, I would say. But even now, the relationships you strike up perhaps away from the Tour de France over months and years, you know, they do sort of pay you back if in a way at the Tour de France, because people will, you know, they will spare time for you even though they're in their most stressful. So I don't necessarily see any of that changing, and I don't necessarily see the dynamic between the people covering the sport and the people participating changing dramatically over the next few years. But I did read something by one of the cricket correspondents on the eve of the Ashes, sort of complaining that the press and the media no longer kind of travel together, stay drink in the bars together after, you know, training sessions, and no longer kind of have that two-way rapport. And that's undoubtedly happening across all sports. But I don't necessarily think that cycling is going to, our jobs are not necessarily going to change radically, because we've got the opportunity to go to the lower key races, or training camps or whatever,
which will
always happen, and that's where you kind of do your legwork, do the groundwork, that then when it comes to the tour give you something back.
And also that very intimate access is a bit of a double-edged sword, because as we've seen, the perhaps were journalists in the past who got too pally with riders and too embedded in the scene, and that prevented them from reporting.
Again, though, that had its roots in a very practical concern that journalists had, where they didn't see the race on telly. The only way they could find out what happened was to speak to the riders, and then that would be the way that they would write the stories. They would piece together what happened from talking to the riders. So that sort of access back then was necessary, wasn't it?
But perhaps it's even, you could argue, even more necessary today, because everyone has seen the television footage.
No,
you don't want to just rehash
absolutely.
What everyone's already knows.
Yeah, I mean, the thing to bear in mind is that every day of the tour there are 200 stories, aren't there? For 200 riders in the race, there are 200 experiences, all probably quite different.
Yeah, I think one of the other things about cycling is that there isn't one definitive narrative on any given day or any given race or any given tour.
You can make stuff up, can't you?
I've made this point before. I mean, one of the things that kind of, I mean, I'm a keen sort of student of the history of the sport, but I always have this doubt about these single sourced versions of history that have been passed down and passed down and passed down. You know, how, like you're saying there, Richard, how did we come to understand these stories when there wasn't extensive television footage? The journalists...
Oh, I'm not saying it was all true.
No, exactly. So therefore, a lot of the stories, the myths of the tour that have been passed down are... They are exactly that. And I don't think necessarily that we need to have some kind of truth and reconciliation on that and peel back the layers until we find a more mundane truth. But I do think that we're living in an era now where people know more about cycling and the Tour de France than they possibly ever could have done. And yet, there's still so much that we don't know and that we can't possibly sort of unearth, because there just aren't enough hours in the day on the Tour de France. And obviously we gravitate towards the more important stories. But like you're saying, I don't think that we'll ever reach a point where there isn't something interesting to say, something interesting to write about. And I think the one danger of the direction that things have gone in recently is this quest to have one definitive account of any particular event. And I just don't think that, necessarily that's something we should be pursuing.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Competition time. We've got two competitions to announce this week, one winner and one continuation. We continue with the mystery voice. Nobody has got that yet. A few guesses for Jens Voigt, one for Graham O'Bree. Incorrect, both. So please have another go. The prize is a copy of my book, Sky's the Limit, and we'll add to it this week with all three volumes of the Cycling Anthology. So here is the clip.
You should not become the fool of the media. Should not become the fool of a liar like him.
So that was our clip of a mystery voice. Please enter the competition by tweeting at humansinvent hashtag mystery voice. Prize is a copy of Sky's the Limit, my book by Team Sky. And we'll add in, since this is an anthology podcast, we'll add in all three volumes of the Cycling Anthology. So please have another go at guessing the mystery voice. Here's the clip again.
You should not become the fool of the media. Should not become the fool of a liar like him.
And our next competition was a special competition, thanks to Ian Cleverley, who joined us last week, the deputy editor of Ruler magazine. Ian brought with him beautiful new Ruler annual, which, as I said, covers this year's tour. Stunning, huge book. And his question was, which number annual is this year's? And the answer was number 7, which a lot of you got. And we picked at random out the hat Gregory John. So congratulations, Gregory.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Before we wrap this up, I want to talk about a piece that's in the volume 2 of the Cycling Anthology, which is about Linus Gerdeman. Relevant because he's kind of making a return to the big time next year. But Daniel, you wrote a chapter about Linus Gerdeman. I mean, your approach to that was interesting, because it wasn't an interview with Gerdeman. You did speak to him, but it was essentially a profile of him based on numerous interviews with people who he knew and who he'd ridden with. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, why you chose that approach rather than interviewing Gerdeman directly, and also a little bit about what we might expect from him next year, do you think?
Well, it was a very curious story. The reason I chose it was that Linus Gerdeman, 6 years after wearing the yellow jersey in the Tour de France and being hailed as, you know, the more talented, the Jan Ulrich, the, you know, a future Tour winner, found himself without a contract. And, you know, no one was really talking about this, no one was really scandalised by this. It seemed quite normal because while he'd had reasonable results, he'd won the Tour of Luxembourg, I think, 2 years before. He had certainly not lived up to the promise he'd shown. And, you know, again, going back to the point I made earlier about Oscar Freire, I think one of the very interesting things about writing about personalities in cycling is that, you know, they come into contact with so many people over the course of a career, and by the time someone has spent 10 years in the peloton, their story becomes so textured, there's so much to say about them. And it's also, I was intrigued by the idea of, you know, someone who had done very well in their career and ostensibly
still winning the odd race,
fulfilled a lot of their childhood dreams, but found himself in a position whereby he was being criticised, he was being called arrogant, he was being called disruptive. And, you know, like I say, it was someone who had actually had a very respectable career. But and it also, I think...
How old is he now?
He's 30
so,
or 31
you know,
now.
Right at the peak, he was sort of left high and dry with that contract.
Yeah, and there were a lot of interesting elements to that story about, just also about how one forges a successful career in cycling, and it's not only about results, it's also about who you know, how you're perceived, and that is very, very important in cycling. And I think Jörg Jaksha, I spoke to when I was writing that piece, he made a point about certain riders, German riders, who in spite of the crisis in German cycling had managed to find contract after contract purely because they were well liked. Danilo Hondo was a good example of that, and I think he's even got a contract next year. Whereas Linus Gerdeman, and one of his friends said something very interesting to me when I was writing that piece, was, I mean, Linus Gerdeman was quite a good-looking chap. I think he's still,
Lady Gaga.
Yeah, Lady Gaga, Brian Holm called him. I think he's still dating a lingerie model. But one of his good friends said Linus has always had this problem that he's good-looking and he's very quiet as well at the same time. And when you combine those two things, people automatically think you're arrogant. And in his friends...
Alice is nodding
knowingly. I was nodding at you, actually.
this perception had followed Linus Gerdeman around, and also he came from a fairly untypical background for a cyclist. His family were fairly wealthy. The famous story about him, this comes back to what we were saying before about Oscar Freire, a very minor trivial detail, but something which, you know, can really illuminate a story, add a lot of colour to it. He turned up to his first training camp at CSC with a full set of Louis Vuitton, it's been said that he showed up with a full set of Louis Vuitton luggage. In fact, I think he just had one little man bag in that. That was his version anyway. But and this image, this story had been, you know, in cycling, these stories get repeated and repeated and repeated, and it followed him around for his whole career, this story, and people had formed this impression of him that he was, you know, aloof and, you know, a little bit snotty. And, you know, this was one of the reasons why his career had ultimately faltered. I was surprised that after it, he didn't find a contract, was out of the sport for a year, took a gap year. And I know that, you know, a lot of other people I spoke to when I was writing the piece, they were pessimistic about his chance of getting back into the sport, particularly with the economic climate as it was. And he spent the year, I think, doing up an old house in Mallorca, not Interrailing. But he has actually managed to get back into the sport, I think largely because he's very good friends with Gerald Sielek, the winner of Milan-San Remo last year. And Sielek's been very successful at the MTM Quebeca African-based team, and Gerdeman will ride for them next year.
Have you had any contact with him since? Because you had a problem. He was proved to be very elusive, didn't he?
Yeah, but I think he was just a bit shambolic.
Yeah, shambolic. He lost his phone.
He lost his phone continually. And,
that old chestnut.
Yeah. But
what do you think? How do you think he'll get on?
I mean, another interesting aspect of that story was that, again, he'd been the victim, and I'm actually writing another story about another rider like this at the moment, Damiano Cunego. he was the victim of the press, in particular, having taken advantage of a set of circumstances. In Gerdeman's case, it was the fact that he took the yellow jersey 10 years exactly after Jan Ulrich had taken it, and also the fact that German cycling was imploding because of doping, and Gerdeman seemed to be very stridently anti-doping. So it was a great story, and because it was a great story, the German press had also built him up more than he deserved to be built up. I mean, yeah, he wasn't as good as was made out at the time. So, you know, his results throughout his career showed that even when he took the yellow jersey in the Tour, it was at the end of a breakaway. It wasn't, as the French say, à la pedale. So I think he's a good rider. He can do pretty much everything. He can time trial, he can climb, he can even sprint a little bit. He can win stages in 1 week.
Just a couple of years ago.
In quite a big group in a sprint.
Yeah.
So I think he'll win a couple of races. I don't think if that team ever rises to the Tour de France, I don't think he'll ever sort of threaten the top 10. But
I mean, it'd be fascinating because it's very unusual for someone to take a year out and come back.
Yeah.
You know, very unusual. Just moving on to another Lady Gaga, Ellis. Tell us, Ellis, right, this in the latest cycling anthology you've got, I must admit I've not played this game yet, but you've got a game. It's a game.
It is. My chapters are kind of a sort of choose-your-own-adventure style story.
What was the inspiration for this?
Game books, they're called officially, I think. I suppose, well, as editors, Lionel and I kind of invariably kind of write our pieces more towards the end. We're sort of busy editing people's pieces and chasing them up and getting them in, so
we perhaps
need to change this and write our chapters first for the next volume, but you sort of, you know, get an overview of what's in the book, what's come in, and then it was just an idea I had a little while ago. I sort of thought, well, you know, maybe should include a chapter that's a little bit different. And I mean, not to, you know, everyone's chapters have been great, but I guess I've always thought that, you know, maybe as writers in something like the anthology, you could and should perhaps take some risks a little bit, perhaps do something a little bit out there, a bit more left field. So yeah, just
Did
had
anyone
this
played the game?
I played the game. Yeah, I played the game. Obviously, when I first when I had the first read of it, and I think for those who don't know, I think probably if you're in your early 30s and a bit older, you may remember these role play game books. From sort of the mid 80s, I think they were very popular.
I think they still exist today.
Yeah,
but it
was big in
the 80s.
You read a section, and then
at
the end of the section, you're given a choice whether to take scenario A or scenario B, and then depending on which choice you turn to. That particular page and the story unfolds.
So it's follow a break or...
EPO or blood transfusion.
it's a doping-free story. I must admit, I almost did include things like that, and I thought, you know what, that's almost too obvious. So there are about, I think, you know, there are obviously a number of different outcomes, different endings, and sort of the objective really in this is to try and either get your contract extended or...
The fact that it's locked in a kind of in a sort of gritty reality. It's not like you can choose a path to winning the Tour de France as a first year pro. It's literally can you win a contract for the following year?
It's intentional that you're more like a journeyman pro as opposed to being a champion.
Reason, obviously, as co-editors, kind of we have a dialogue about this, you know, and Ellis said, "Do you think this will work?" And I thought, well, in this instance, I'm supposed to be kind of the checks and balances, and I'm supposed to either say, "Look, I don't think that's a good idea," or
"But you've got another contract.
Why don't we give it a whirl?" And I think with the first book, Ellis had sort of said he would quite like to write a piece of poetry at some point. You know, I didn't know
if I was going to be the one to do it, but I said maybe it's something that we could have in there. And actually, we did get a reader as well later did come back and talk about poetry
like
as well.
Poem,
so,
yeah.
But I just think it's an opportunity that, you know, again, like we said earlier, you wouldn't in the newspaper or cycling magazine.
That's a good reason for that.
The anthology is, it's, you know, £8.99. There's 14, I think, chapters in it, you know, so I mean it's per chapter, what's that? I mean, it's
all right, Lionel, enough of the sales pitch.
45 pence of somebody's money per chapter, something like that. And I think if we, in this format, couldn't take a little bit of a risk and push the kind of boundaries of convention a bit, then we would never get the opportunity to do so. So I think it works really well. It's entertaining.
Daniel's off to write a bally about people. Yeah, inspired.
Wonderful.
Right, well, I think that we'll leave it there, will we? Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
A little wave there as well. Nice.
My trademark.
Sun's just going down over the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah, well spotted, Daniel.
What a beautiful moment.
Ellis, thank you for joining us.
Cheers, Richard.
Thanks all.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.